This is the second in a series on the Radical Luther. This one is entitled Marks of the Church Persecution. And as you can tell, my voice has been persecuted over the last day and a half. I have a cold, and who knows when the voice will go out. If it does, I will try to use the PA system and whisper to you. It may be the most intimate class that you have here at Holden. Let me tell you a story first. Not a story, so much as an experience that I had in 1983. 1983 was the 500th anniversary of Luther's birth. You know, we're 500 years old if we were right about when he was born, and we may not be right. But in any case, we decided we would celebrate it in 1983. And the International Luther Congress, made up of some 400 Luther scholars from all over the world, including Japan and Latin America and India and all, met in the in East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, in the city of Erfurt for the 6th International Luther Congress. In preparation for that, I had spent almost a month in West Germany doing research, and then went over to East Germany for the conference itself. And one thing struck me. In West Germany, I went to church, and I was almost alone in the church. Very few people were there. It was a good Lutheran service in German. It was fun. Not many people. Went over to East Germany, German Democratic Republic, where the church is, until very recently, has been severely persecuted. Until very recently, you remember the church, your children weren't allowed into the university, your children weren't allowed into apprenticeship schools, all sorts of disabilities. This had changed only a few years earlier, and still there was a lot of tension. It was obvious in the humor that was told. But in East Germany, I went to church, and the churches were full. Not just dozens, but hundreds of people. Talked to some parents, and they said, how many of you have teenage children? How many of you have teenage children that are a bit rebellious? You're not going to admit to it here with them watching. In East Germany, if you were a teenager and rebellious, you joined the church. Now, they both spoke German. They were Lutheran, or what they were called evangelical. Yet in West Germany, there were very few. In East Germany, there were quite a few, large numbers. And they were made up significant numbers of youth. Why is that so? Is the question that I asked myself and I asked some of the people there. And I hope that today we can discuss why that might be so. Martin Luther, as you know, initiated the Reformation in the early 16th century over the issue of justification by faith alone. But soon he found himself in conflict with the Catholic Church of his time. Soon he was excommunicated by the Catholic Church under the ban of outlawry in the empire and forced to help create a church of his own, at least an institutional church of his own, since his attempt at reforming the Catholic Church had gone awry. Within a few years of that attempt, he found himself embattled not only on the side of the Catholics, but also on the side of those people who thought he hadn't reformed enough. Individuals who thought that although he had made some important changes, that he just was taking too much time. He was allowing things that were what were called remnants of popery still in his church, and that they had to finish the job that he started. And so he found himself on two flanks, being attacked from two different directions, or actually more than two, from Catholics, but also from various individuals who Luther called Schwärmer, or fanatics, which we today call Reformed, Anabaptist, and others. At issue in these discussions with both Catholics and with people, we'll the Schwärmer. I'll use that term, although they would not appreciate being called Schwärmer. Schwärmer means enthusiast. That's how we translate it. But literally, the closest thing is bees in the bonnet, because they're flying around, swarms. And these are swarmers, you know, real enthusiasts. That's how Luther described them. One of the issues was, who was the true church? I mean, which one of them? I mean, were the Catholics, were Luther and his followers, or were these other people the true church? The real issue was, how does one recognize the true church? Voice is going. You could do a betting pool and see how long it takes. Now, traditionally, in the Roman Catholic Church, I mean, there was already division back in the Greek Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church had divided from each other in the 10th and the 11th centuries. There had been other disagreements in the 15th century. The Hussites, Bohemian Christians, had broken away from the Roman Catholic Church over a variety of issues. And so the church had spent some time thinking about what were the true marks, how you recognize the church. Nevertheless, there was no clear theology of what constituted a true church, no clear medieval theology. And as we'll see, Luther himself didn't develop a clear and certainly not a coherent theology of the church. Nevertheless, the traditional four marks, or what are called the marks of the church, when I originally gave this, there are about four marks in my congregation. I gave it in my congregation, and Mark Opgren and Mark Hermanson and Mark Edwards and several others, and they thought it was about us. But the nota ecclesia, the marks of the church, traditionally were, they were unified. There was one unity. The church was holy. The church was Catholic, that is, universal, and apostolic, that is, it could trace itself back to the original apostles. Well, now all of these various bodies, you no longer could claim unity because things had splintered. Now, the Catholic Church said, you've splintered off of us and we're still united. Holiness, well, that was a matter of debate. You could find any number of problems in the Catholic Church of Luther's time, but frankly, as soon as Luther's church was in place, you could find lots of problems in it, too. Catholicity, universalness, as I say, that was an issue. The apostolic background was also highly disputed, and so Luther had to come up essentially with a new understanding of how one recognizes the true church. In doing this, he made a distinction. It's a distinction which goes back to Augustine, but in fact, he transformed it in some interesting ways between the visible and the invisible church. He pointed out that the true church, the body of Christ, was invisible. You couldn't tell who was or what was the invisible church with certainty. But there was also a visible church, and the visible church and the indivisible church went together. In other words, Luther didn't create the notion of a church that was somehow floating around that you couldn't tell. The invisible church, he said, was like the soul which inhabits a body, and the body is the visible church. But the visible church was made up of both the saved and the sinners. I mean, everyone was sinners, but the saved and the damned. So you could be in the visible church, and you might not be in the invisible church, but at least the visible church could be recognized, and he said it could be recognized in several ways. And what I would like to do now is share with you some of these ways, raise a few questions. I'm not going to go into as many issues or tell as many stories or read as many quotes as I would if I had a better voice. And then I'm going to throw it open and ask you to talk about, well, in our society, what do we think of these suggestions? Can we recognize the true church? Are these any help in recognizing the true church? The primary definition, according to Luther, of what constituted the true church was the true church is where the word was properly preached and the sacraments rightly administered. Word and sacraments. Word and sacraments. Some Lutherans added a third point, discipline was rightly exercised. And that was really picked up by the Reform. But the real issue was the word properly preached. The issue was on preaching. Now here when we talk about the word with Lutherans, we're talking about preaching. We're not talking about the Bible. It's true the word is in the Bible, but the primary emphasis is on the word coming, being preached and received in faith by individuals. And the sacraments, of course, would be baptism and the Eucharist. And for Luther, also the sacrament of penance or confession. He actually had three sacraments. instead of two that we mainly emphasize today. Although, if you've noticed, if you've ever looked in the Green Book, we do have a sacrament. We don't call it a sacrament. We have a rite of confession or penance in the Green Book. I don't know if any of you have ever used it, but it's there in case you ever want to. So that initially was the definition, but that really didn't do it well enough in distinguishing Lutherans from Catholics, much less Lutherans from some of the other groups. Now, I mean, Luther said that, yes, the Catholics often had the word, the correct word, and did have the sacraments. They weren't always rightly administered. He also said that some of the Reformed had the word, or a good deal of it, a good deal of the sacraments, even though they disagreed on such things as the way in which Christ was present in the sacrament. And so later in his career, when he was particularly embattled in the 1530s and dealing with Catholics and dealing with the Reformed, he added some additional marks, which he had derived both from the scripture and from the history of the church in the New Testament as he read it, but also in the history of the early church. What happened to that church? What are sorts of visible things that happened to that church or that church did which marked it, stamped it, as a true church? And he developed a couple lists, and the lists don't always correspond completely, but I'm going to share with you the list he produced. He put into a book called Wider Hans Wurst, Against Hans Wurst, or we would probably translate it Against Jack Sausage. This was an attack on a Catholic prince in which Hans Wurst, or Jack Sausage, was a comedy figure who wore a sausage around his neck and was performed in various farces. And this Catholic prince had said that Luther had called his own prince Hans Wurst. And Luther replied by saying that this other prince was the true Hans Wurst, and he should shit in his pants and put it around his neck like a Wurst and gobble it down like the sow that he was. This was pure Luther. But in this quite vitriolic and scatological treatise, there's a section on the marks of the true church, which was so well thought of by Lutherans that it was excerpted and published apart from comments about Hans Wurst. And from this, I'm drawing a number of the points here. Luther said that the true church possessed the word, the true church possessed baptism, the true church possessed the Lord's Supper, properly understood. The true church possessed the office of the keys, and in fact, I'm going to give this class again in 2 weeks, and we'll do one on the office of the keys, because that's discipline. It's the church disciplining its own members. Another is calling or ordination. The true church called people to be pastors and bishops, and that's another one I'm going to do in 2 weeks, because the whole issue of ordination. Prayer and thanksgiving to God. And the last one is the one we're doing today, and that was what he called bearing the cross, or spiritual temptations, or what I've sort of summarized as persecution. I want to read a quote to you. Two quotes, actually, voice permitting. Nobody can deny, he wrote, that we experience the same suffering as St. Paul says in 1 Peter, or St. Peter says in 1 Peter, as our brethren in the world. That is, Luther is looking back and saying the true church has always suffered persecution. You look in the New Testament, it's persecuted. You look in the early church, it's persecuted. And he says we're being persecuted too. We are persecuted in every place, strangled, drowned, hanged, and tormented in every way for the sake of the word. Our lot is like that of the ancient church, and in this we are beyond measure like it, so that we may well say we are the true ancient church, or at least its companion and co-partners in suffering. For this is not something we have newly invented, but something we really experience. Indeed, we, like this same ancient church, are like the Lord Christ himself on the cross. There are Annas and Caiaphas, together with the priests, standing in front of the cross, vilifying the Lord after crucifying him. The Pope, the cardinals, and the monks have likewise condemned, damned, and murdered us, shedding our blood and reviling us as well. The soldiers, that is, some of the temporal powers, stand there and also revile us. Or in another place, in his On the Councils in the Church, he wrote, the holy Christian people are externally recognized by the holy possession of the sacred cross. They must endure every misfortune and persecution, all kinds of trials and evil from the devil, the world, and the flesh, as the Lord's Prayer indicates. My inward sadness, timidity, fear, outward poverty, contempt, illness, and weakness, in order to become like their head, Christ. And the only reason they must suffer is that they steadfastly adhere to Christ and God's word, enduring this for the sake of Christ. At another point, Luther commented, and I got my notes all mixed up, so I have to find it. Luther said, whenever the word is properly preached and the sacraments are rightly administered, the devil shows up. And Luther believed in the devil in a way that it's very difficult for us to do. The devil for him was a real force in the world, a force behind many of his opponents, or all of his opponents, a force actively involved. And he wrote at one time, now when the devil saw that God built such a holy, find the next page here. I get for going out of order. Now, when the devil saw that God built such a holy church, he was not idle and erected his chapel beside it, larger than God's temple. Luther insisted that wherever is the true church, you'll also find the devil's chapel right next door. What I'd like to do, and this is set up like a lecture, and I'm programmed, as I said before, to go 45 minutes when I have a lot of people sitting in rows looking at me. I wish that we were more in a circle, because I really at this point want to save my voice and ask you. I want to talk about two things. One, is persecution a mark of the true church? And if it is, where's the persecution among our churches? I mean, when you talk about timidity and fear and suffering, and then you look at, you know, Evangelical Lutheran Church on the Hill with 1,500 members and three pastors, and people are doing real, you know, middle class and doing real well. Where is the persecution there? Where is the devil's chapel? Or to go back to the story that with which I opened this discussion, East Germany has a vibrant church, a live church, a church which is growing rather than shrinking, in which young people, out of rebellion against their parents, perhaps, are joining. Whereas West Germany, free, independent, wealthy, the church is almost empty. Do we have here one of the marks of the true church operating? But let's leave East Germany behind for a while. I mean, we can speak about East and West Germany anytime. Let's deal with us in our own backyard. What persecution is there of our church today? Where is the devil's chapel?
You can't hear, raise your hand. You can't talk.
I think that it is something which is within our churches themselves, and I will speak about in relation to my home church. I won't attempt to speak for anyone else's, but I suspect that in many cases the same thing happens. The church has lost its sense of mission and is concerned more with perpetuating itself as a social organization within a community. So take an example, someone coming home from a Holden-type experience, a real renewal, and is treated as a kook, a weirdo, you know, a fanatic. We don't want those kinds of people. And I've seen that. I've experienced it in my own church for quite some time, not just myself, but others, that the organizational church is not really interested in anything which is renewal, excitement. It's the, you know, that simply let's continue going through the forms. It's visible, but there's nothing there.
Well, let me make a couple points to both of yours that I maybe will help sharpen the discussion. Luther insisted there had to be a visible church. You could not have drive-in churches, you know, where, or people who sit in there watching their TV. least from his, of course he didn't have TV, but the true church had to gather together. It had to gather to worship and to participate in the sacraments. And so you couldn't do it by television. You couldn't do it, you know, by reading and being pious on your own. So we really are talking about institutional churches here. But are they the true church? So I'll get back to the Devil's Chapel, but think about your own churches. Do they, as an institution, are they suffering? I mean, we talk about derision. Of course, I mean, the very earliest evidence that we have of the church from the book of Acts shows that already what was the true church was Paul's letters indicate that, I mean, Paul is the one that coins the notion, the word in Galatians, of false brethren. So the devil, in Luther's terms, the devil chapel was established in Galatia. You know, right there at the beginning. Get some more other people who haven't commented yet, and then I'll come back to some that are actively involved in the discussion. Well, for Luther, the center of the gospel, was Christus treibet, pushes Christ, which emphasizes Christ. And so the proper preaching of the gospel was that which preached Christ and the promise, specifically the promise of announced and enacted through Christ on the cross, the death and the resurrection, and the proper administration of the sacraments were ones that were visible embodiments of the invisible promise. The most important part of the Lord's Supper for Luther was at that point when you're kneeling or standing and receiving the elements, and the pastor or the person who's distributing it says, "This is, His body given for you," and when you receive that individual world, or "This is His blood shed for you," because at that point you have a combination of the visible, tangible reality, bread and wine, conjoined with the word of promise and being personally received. And so that basically the proper preaching is preaching which preaches Christ and the promise of justification by faith alone. And he uses that also as the canon within the canon of dealing with Scripture. And the proper sacraments were sacraments in which visible items were conjoined with invisible promise. And for that reason, there's really only two sacraments, perhaps three, because the baptism, you have the water, visible sign, combined with the promise of being born into the death and resurrection of Christ. In baptism, and then, as I just said, with the Lord's Supper, there's the tangible elements and the individual word of promise. So, briefly, that still leaves much range for disagreement. But let me ask another question, unless someone else would like to. I want to sharpen this a bit. What about women in church? You know, we've been talking about inclusive language. I don't want to get into a long argument about it now because we had the forum last night. But what about women or people like the woman that came to you, but women generally who might feel it because of the male orientation of the language, they're not being included? Are they persecuted? Are they, in fact, then part of the true church by that very fact? 47% and then the 2% is other. I thought you said 51-47, and I was. How many think that more women attend your particular congregation than men on any day? They're cramming for their final exam. So. How many of your congregations allow women to distribute it at the Eucharist? Do any of you don't have congregations where they don't? I mean, in Indiana, Kentucky, that's a big problem. There are a number of congregations where that's a problem. One delicious story was where the Worship and Ministry Committee finally set up two women. So it couldn't, I mean, you gave the man one. And, no, I mean, that's very clear. and Luther himself insisted that because the Anabaptists were suffering persecution, which they certainly were, did not make them the true church. These other things had to go together. I mean, you look at Jonestown, for example. You can come up with other examples.
Does he distinguish between persecution of the visible and the invisible church? In other words, when we're talking about women, for example, we're talking about individual Christians being persecuted, but that's not a systemic persecution of the visible church.
Well, one could argue that it was still, individual women, but if it's a policy of the church to do certain things. Good point, but remember, he likens it to the body and soul. You don't find the invisible church apart from the visible church. I mean, they always go together, but you can't necessarily separate the two. And we're the visible church here gathered. Now, some of you may not be in the invisible church. We can't tell. But the two always go together. You don't find the invisible church apart from the visible, no more than you find a soul apart from the body. At least we haven't been able to yet.
Within Luther's understanding, if any one of those conditions were not met, did that disqualify from being the true church?
Yep.
Okay.
He would be very suspicious.
Mm-hmm. So any one of those, not just...
Luther, when he talks about persecution, it tends to mean both physical persecution, and after all, shortly after he died in February that summer, there was a war in which Catholic forces attempted to literally wipe out Lutheranism. And there were people being burned and drowned and strangled for heresy.
And the Lutherans were burning and drowning.
Well, actually, the Lutherans did some, but as a general rule, they exiled rather than burned. I mean, I'm not claiming that they have higher moral ground, but as a general rule, Protestants tended, if they were going to beat up on something, they would beat up on things. They'd destroy images and break windows and what have you. Whereas Catholics tended to localize sacrilege in people. Well, of course, Luther would be made uncomfortable with any number of things in the 20th century. Automobiles. One thing I want you to think about in closing, because I think we still have 5 minutes, but I'd like to move on to the Devil's Chapel. Let me make one point. How many of you have read the Screwtape letters? I'm familiar with them. They're delightful. They're over there. They're written by a somewhat prudish Anglican, C.S. Lewis. And so there are some parts of them which at least I have difficulty with. But it points out that the letter from the Screwtape, the Devil, Superior.
No. The junior tempter, Wormwood.
Oh, Wormwood, that's right. Well, they have the conversation and he's in training. And he says that, the very best thing that the devil works is to get people not to believe that he or she or it exists. The best thing. For Luther, one of the most serious forms of persecution of other people claiming to be the true church were Catholics claiming to be the true church for Luther. And he often, where he saw the devil in chapel, was often in these competing denominations. Now we live in a pluralistic society. Tolerant pluralistic society. Does this argument make you uncomfortable? The devil's chapel. The devil's chapel is not, it's not Dow Chemical or Amazor, or the devil's chapel is not either a right-wing or left-wing tyranny. The devil's chapel is something that pretends to be the church.
That doesn't make me uncomfortable at all. In fact, I almost mentioned it a while ago. But I think our perception of that would be a little broader than Luther's. I was wondering whether the church is persecuted in the form of groups like the Mormons, for example, that are not a Christian group, and yet which masquerade as a Christian group, and which are so in tune with our society that they're much more successful than the true church, if we're put quotations around that, in terms of attracting people to their doctrine and to their fellowship.
You know, earlier you brought up the television evangelists and some of their ministry. You know, there are jokes going around, but it's really not funny.
It wasn't funny before.
No. Some of the jokes are funny. But where is the devil chapel? Luther at least insisted that there always are false brethren, always false prophets. He's not making this up. What he does is he looks at the history of the church found in the Hebrew Scriptures and in the New Testament. And he says, look at throughout Hebrew Scriptures, there are the prophets, but there are always false prophets. He says it begins with Cain and Abel. The Cain is the founder of the false church, Luther argues. That the devil's chapel, therefore, is always there, wherever there's the true church, beginning back at the very beginning, all the way through the Old Testament history, all the way through the New Testament, and then through church history. There always has to be the devil's chapel. What do you think of that idea?
Well, going back to Screwtape, it's going to be different for each one of us because Screwtape or Wormwood will approach each one of us at his weakest point. So it will be a different one for each person's experience. I experience it in my certain way. Someone else is going to have a very different type of a...
But of course we're talking about institution.
To add to the confusion of it all, there's a label. Those false prophets also sincerely believed what they were saying. It wasn't just, let's confuse people here.
Oh, no. I mean, sincerity is the devil's greatest tool. We're going to have to quit now. I hope that you'll think about this and talk about it amongst yourselves. It's an important issue because I think that even if you don't have to accept Luther's word for it, the history, just read the Old and New Testament. This is such a common theme. Or if you study church history. It's an issue in a society where we have religious freedom. I think it's an issue that some pointed to. Tomorrow, 10:25, we're doing Just War. I'm doing Just War. There are other good things going on. Most of you may not know even what Just War is, and you'll be, I'm sure, surprised at what Luther has to say about it. So I hope to see some of you tomorrow. And now I think we're supposed to get ready for Vespers.